Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Beirut is Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation, and he writes the International's column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasiskambanis.com. He's the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his forthcoming book is about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you as always, Ian.
And you're right next door to Syria there, and the Syrian opposition, who I guess feel that they're being sold out by this Russian-American deal, have said that already Assad is shipping out his chemical weapons to Iraq, Iran, and to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Is there any truth to that?
Well, we obviously don't know any solid information about that, and I think if the U.S. could credibly pin that down, they would make a big public fuss about that, because that violates the very heart of this agreement. Now, it's possible, of course, to sneak small quantities of this stuff around, and there's absolutely no reason to trust Bashar Assad here. I mean, that's the bottom line behind those rumors, is that this guy has nobody's best interest at heart but his own, and he has zero compunction about violating international norms and killing civilians in any manner, including using chemical weapons. So he's still dangerous.
Well, but the Israelis would strike. And isn't that why they've struck already inside Syria? Because they believe that weapons are being transferred to Hezbollah? So if this were to happen, it would invite an Israeli strike, wouldn't it?
If it were to happen and be noticed or known. And I think the chemical weapons issue gets, in some ways, an unfair amount of attention, because as we've, I think, discussed before, even us on the show, conventional weapons have killed far more people in this conflict than chemical weapons, and whether, you know, it's the Israeli perspective where they're worried about Scuds far more than, say, a sarin gas attack over the Golan, or whether you're talking about the Syrian uprising, which, again, has suffered much more at the hands of conventional, just regular standard-issue mortar shells than at the hand of chemical weapons. That's the real sort of muscle of this regime. And in the past, when Israel struck inside Syria during this conflict, it was because the regime was believed to be transferring long-range or mid-range rockets, conventional rockets now, the Scuds or the like, to Hezbollah. And that sort of munition doesn't in any way fall under the purview of this agreement. And that sort of munition is in some ways quite easy to move under the radar. I mean, I think we assume for all the times that the American intelligence or the Israeli military made a public fuss or a strike over some purported weapons transfer, we assume that there's 10 times that the regime and Hezbollah have made such transfers successfully or attempted them without and gotten away with it.
So what is the reaction in Lebanon to this deal? The concern was that an American strike would inflame the region and possibly spread this from a war inside Syria to a more regional war. And already you've had some spillover into Lebanon with some bombing of Hezbollah and then a retaliation against a Sunni cleric in Tripoli. So what's the mood there?
Well, the mood, in one word, is anxious. And to elaborate, as usual, America doesn't get any credit for anything, whether it's refraining from irresponsible use of force or using it. So there's two general lines of reaction. One is from people who support the Syrian opposition, people who essentially wanted an American strike, and more than that, they want a real definitive conflict-altering intervention by the United States. These are people who would love to see ground troops come in or advisors or sustained airstrikes, a no-fly zone, all those sorts of interventions. So those folks are angry and disappointed, and they say, look at this, even in the face of an almost genocidal, sort of horrendous transgression of all our Western values, here the United States essentially slithering out of its moral responsibilities with a deal that, you know, politically saves face, but in real terms leaves the Syrian people hostage to the vicious machinations of Bashar al-Assad. On the other side, the folks who are either pro-regime or simply who want to see America keep out of it, They don't give any credit to the United States for doing this in an effective or diplomatic way. They say, ha, see, once again, America shows weakness and indecision, and even though in this instance we've escaped their ham-handed clumsiness, we are in no way reassured because the manner in which it happened leaves us convinced that America has no policy in the region and no strategic vision, and is sort of bumbling through. So we have a little bit less anxiety than we had about a week ago, but we have to we have to live with the fact that America basically gets criticized and either blamed for being responsible for everything wrong or blamed for being too weak to solve any problems. And either way, it's a lot of naysaying.
Again, I'm speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis in Beirut. He's a fellow at the Century Foundation, and he writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe. And his latest book is A Privilege to Die Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his forthcoming book is about the Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. Now, you've been spending a lot of time in Cairo and in Egypt, and of course, it's somewhat been forgotten because of Syria's been in the headlines, but clearly the revolution in Egypt has taken a turn for the worst. For all intents and purposes, Mubarak is being rehabilitated. This clearly pleases the Saudis and the Israelis. I imagine the Egyptian opposition is very demoralized. I spoke to one of the leaders of the original revolution some time back when they were going after the Muslim Brotherhood, and he said, you wait, they'll come after the liberals once they've nailed the Brotherhood, and that seems to be exactly what's happening.
Yeah, it's an incredibly depressing turn of events in Egypt, and to try and look at some of the regional parallels here, I think there's some really striking ones. Number one, we see the real persistence of the old state system. We see this in Bashar al-Assad's resurgence, surviving so much of the uprising and then turning around and pulling off this chemical weapons deal that looks in some ways like it might keep him in power, if not forever, for a lot longer. And that, I think, very clearly parallels what happened in Egypt, where after 2.5 years of revolutionary ferment and hope and, you know, Islamists in politics, liberals in politics, what we've seen primarily in the last month is the old system rearing its head and showing that it is almost entirely intact. And as you said, when they started going after the liberals, it was no surprise because the way that they deposed Morsi and immediately moved to outlaw the Muslim Brotherhood and kill and arrest its supporters was very much the style, not just of the Mubarak regime, but even of the Nasser, the early years of Nasser in the 1950s, when he had a similarly violent and pervasive crackdown. So we've seen that sort of the worst of the old Arab state system coming up. We've also seen an American fatigue with transformation and change. And this is another sad parallel. In Egypt, the U.S. government has seemed content not to call this coup a coup so that it can keep on giving aid, and to essentially bet on, make that same old horrible bet on stability over representational government and fair government. And I see, honestly and sadly, a parallel in the way the U.S. is talking about Syria, because you look beyond the short-term question of the uprising and the chemical weapons attack. What we're seeing is a policy that essentially accepts the prospect of either Bashar al-Assad or a successor in his mold staying indefinitely in power in Syria, because America would rather have that than the democratic alternative, which would include a lot of jihadists and characters that the U.S. either can't manage or can't stomach.
Well, but how do you explain the fickle nature of the support that the United States and particularly progressives in this country had for those kids in Tahrir Square? There was exuberance both here and in Tahrir Square during that revolution and after. And there is no such enthusiasm for the revolution in Syria, which is in many ways similar. I mean, the people rose up spontaneously. Eventually, the Islamists infiltrated, if you will, the revolution. And in the case of Egypt, we love the revolutionaries. In the case of Syria, we don't love them.
I mean, we loved the revolutionaries in Egypt because it was free. It didn't cost us anything to do that. Their rhetoric, at least in the simple way that the public in the U.S. understood it, their rhetoric sounded a lot like American liberal democratic dialectic, even though it was actually a lot more complicated than that. And ultimately, our government, the U.S. government, didn't do any of the things that it could have done to support that revolution. I mean, they didn't put any pressure on the Egyptian military, any meaningful pressure to move away from power in the 2.5 years of the transition. It put no pressure on the Muslim Brotherhood once it was elected to behave in an inclusive and legal and open-minded way, and in the aftermath of this latest coup, it's done nothing again to Sirius to pressure either the civilian government that nominally is in power or the army behind it to curb the abuses. And that that's a real strong contradiction, because I think what you're talking about is something very real, which is the American and Western public's real deep affection for the Egyptian uprising. And you ask, why did they like that and they didn't like Syria? And the real answer, in my view, is a very depressing one. It's not because of anything about the uprising, but it's because of the way that the regime responded. Tahrir looked great because the Mubarak regime was willing to step aside without killing tens of thousands of people. So it looked like a peaceful uprising, which is how it began. The revolution in Syria began the same way, but Bashar al-Assad was willing to kill any and everyone to stop it. So eventually, of course, the uprising resorted to force, and because not of the uprising itself, but because of the regime, we came to view it in a different way.
Well, just in terms, though, of the irony of both Saudi Arabia funding and supporting the return of the military regime in Egypt, and Israel also behind the scenes welcoming it and perhaps helping it restore itself to power. The Israelis, of course, are much more comfortable with Assad than they are with his opposition, but it's the Saudis in the case of Syria that have played right into Assad's hands, because Assad's basic position is it's me or the terrorists, and it's the Saudis who are bringing the terrorists in.
Yeah, I mean, this is best understood as the regional Cold War between Saudi and its allies, the United States and Israel, against Iran and its loose alliance with Russia. And that's really what's going on in Syria as well. And you know, for all the notion that Israel would prefer a stalemate in Syria, or Israel would prefer Assad, Israel has quite actively done some things to support the opposition, and there's quite a lot of reports even of medical aid and some military aid going from Israel to even to jihadists who are fighting the regime. And I've heard from pretty reliable sources here that jihadists in Syria actually don't consider Israel a key enemy. They consider the regime a key enemy, and they're willing to work with Israel in the short term to unseat it. And that is kind of mind-blowing, but it speaks to the real depth of this regional struggle between Iran and the Shia orbit on one side and Saudi and the Sunni orbit on the other.
It certainly brings into question Vladimir Putin's bizarre charge in his op-ed in the New York Times that the jihadis in Syria were planning to strike Israel with chemical weapons. Thanks for joining us here from Beirut, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis in Beirut. He's a fellow at the Century Foundation, and he writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasiskambanis.com. He's the author of A Privilege to Die: Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his forthcoming book is about the Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak.